Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
This is Fiction Predictions,
a new podcast about the greatest books, TV shows and movies from the past that predicted the world we live in today. I'm Sam Haysom.
And I'm Nikolai Nikolov. Sam, are you ready to go down the rabbit hole with me on this one?
Well, I feel like you're going to throw me into the deep end. I feel like with your philosophy background, I feel like I should be worried.
Yeah, you should. but yeah, don't worry, guys. It's not going to be too philosophical. Just a little bit.
Okay.
All right. So, Sam, do you know that prison in the Guardians of the Galaxy where all the main characters get caught up?
If we're going to get out of here, we're going to need to get into that watchtower. And to do that, I'm going to...
Yes, I watched Guardians of the Galaxy for the first time recently, and I remember the prison. The one they sort of... they escape from, don't they? Or...
Yeah. Do you remember how they escape? They basically... They get holed up in the watchtower. So there's a prison, and it's like a circular sort of building, and there's like one central watchtower where...
Look, it's 20 feet up in the air, and it's in the middle of the most heavily guarded part of the prison.
Inmates were being surveilled from.
It's impossible to get up there without being seen.
And the Guardians of the Galaxy sort of get into the tower, and they use it as a ship, and they sort of fly out of the prison.
That was a pretty good plan.
I do remember.
Good. Well, you may be surprised, or you may not be surprised, but that prison is actually based on an 18th century design. And that prison design pretty much predicted the rise of the surveillance society that we live in today.
Ooh, that's a pretty bold claim.
Yes. So my story starts with Jeremy Bentham. He's a British philosopher. Pretty cool guy. He's the father of utilitarianism. And he came up with this prison design called the Panopticon.
Just to quickly break in, remind me what utilitarianism is.
In basic terms, it's the principle that the greatest happiness bestowed on the greatest number of people is actually the best measure to decide between what's right and what's wrong.
Okay, got you.
And Bentham was actually pretty progressive for his time. He actually advocated for the freedom of expression, equal rights for women. He advocated to decriminalize homosexual acts. And funnily enough, he also advocated for animals' rights, which is nice.
Yes, sounds like a good guy.
Yeah, so Bentham is a nice guy. And Bentham was not really happy with the state of prisons in the 18th century. You can potentially imagine that it wasn't a really nice place to be in then. It isn't now, but it definitely wasn't then. And so he sort of designed this new prison called the Panopticon. And it works in a very similar way to the prison in the Guardians of the Galaxy. You have a structure with a central tower, and in that tower there's a watchperson. And the watchperson, or watch people, can see every individual cell in that structure. But from that tower, there's usually like a strong light or something, which means that the people from the cells cannot see who is in the tower. And the basic principle is just the fear that you're being watched makes you sort of police yourself and makes you sort of behave better. And the Panopticon's meaning comes from its name. Pan means all, and opticon means observed, so observing all.
Okay.
Bentham was a pretty smart guy.
Yeah.
Right. So Bentham came up with this idea when he was visiting his brother, Samuel, who was working in Russia in 1786, or then Russia, but in today's sort of geography, it's actually Belarus. Anyway. So it's his brother, who was actually a pretty good inventor himself, who came up with the actual architecture of the building, of the Panopticon, but it was Bentham who sort of came up with the idea of how applying this to institutions, including the prison, but also the school and hospitals, can actually be beneficial both for the people in that institution, but also for the, you know, the people who manage that institution. And he basically argued that it will make those institutions more efficient because you need less people, less guards to take care of the prison. And just the structure itself would make the prisoners or inmates or whatever, according to the structure, they would just act better. Right? Because they were just disciplining themselves.
Because they got this fear that someone might be looking at them.
Yes.
Okay.
So Bentham started writing letters, which he published as a book on the Panopticon in 1787. And the title, I think, is perhaps the first clue of how well he anticipated where we are today. Mm. So the title of this book is called The Panopticon or the Inspection House, containing the idea of a new principle of construction applicable to any sort of establishment in which persons of any descriptions are kept under inspection.
That's a pretty long title.
Yeah, I mean, I think things were different back then.
Yeah, okay.
So here's one quote from those letters. All right, you ready?
Yeah.
Perhaps it is the most important point that the persons to be inspected should always feel themselves as if under inspection. Not only so, but the greater chance there is of a given person's being at a given time actually under inspection, the more strong will be the persuasion, the more intense, if I may say so, the feeling he has of his being so.
Hmm, yeah, okay. That's already, yeah, it's already got a very, like, dystopian vibe, hasn't it? I can imagine that being used, you know how sometimes in books they use, like, a quote at the beginning of a chapter or at the start of the book. I can imagine that going in a kind of the front of a dystopian book or something.
Yeah. Basically, what Bentham is saying in a rather convoluted way is that in this structure where the watch people can see all the inmates, but the inmates cannot see the watchmen, the people will start to discipline themselves. And what he writes is, morals reformed, health preserved, industry invigorated, instruction diffused, public burdens lightened, all by a simple idea in architecture.
Wow, he had some high hopes, didn't he, for this tower, this Panopticon?
Yeah, so it initially was designed as a prison, but in his heart of hearts, Bentham thought that it could be, like, it could work anywhere. It could work, you know, on workers, it could work on children. You could literally turn any building into a Panopticon. All you had to do is have a central tower in the middle of that building, and each individual room or cell can be seen from that tower.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I guess, like, in a school, like, you'd need less teachers maybe to monitor a large number of children if you had a structure like this, and, like, in a workforce, I suppose. This was his thinking.
Exactly. Nobody's invisible.
Okay.
Unfortunately for Bentham, he dedicated nearly 20 years of his life to making the Panopticon happen. And it never did.
Wow. Yeah, that must be hard. He was obviously really invested in this thing, and it must have been tough for him to spend so much time on it and it never to happen.
Since then, until today, basically, several prisons have been built to sort of mimic the Panopticon system. There's, I think the closest one is in Cuba, and there's, like, you can Google it, there's really nice pictures where you just see, you know, a central watchtower, and you see sort of a like a periphery of cells. But all of them fell short from the way that it worked as a whole. And the reason why is we never had the technology needed so that the inmates or whoever the surveillance was being applied upon would not be able to see the watchtower, and likewise for the watchtower to be able to see each and every individual cell clearly. So the Panopticon was never really developed as an actual prison. It was left as a thought process or like an experiment. And then in the 70s, another philosopher.
I hold the bet that most of you
who's this have really flamboyant, super influential Frenchman called Michel Foucault.
Regularly visit a kind of master who takes their money from them in order to teach them how to take care of themselves.
So Foucault comes around and sort of brings back Bentham's Panopticon.
Fortunately enough, I have forgotten, either in French or in English or in German, the name of those modern masters. In antiquity, they were called philosophers.
And Foucault says that the society in which we all live is one where we conform to different behaviors according to where we are. So we act in one way when we're at work, we act another way where, you know, we're in a public place like in the street, and then we act another way we're in a school. The same counts for when, you know, where you were in a courthouse or when you're in a hospital. You follow different, it's a different decorum, right? You feel like you know what you're supposed to do. Your manners and your gestures are according to the place or according to the institutions that you're in.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So Foucault writes this really, really influential book that makes philosophy really, really popular in 1975. And the book is called Discipline and Punish, and the subtitle is A Birth of a Prison.
So while Bentham had this very practical idea of something, of a prison or even a model that could be used elsewhere, Foucault's sort of taking it as a metaphor for a larger...
He just explodes it and applies it to society at large.
Got you.
Bentham had this idea of a panopticon in order to organize a good prison where people could be treated, formed, reformed, and so on.
Your body can be molded according to the function that it serves, right? So if you look at a soldier and the way that they like live together in barracks, like everybody has the same haircut, everybody has the same sort of attire, and they do the same things, and they sort of act as a unit, and it's designed to make everybody homogenous and to like eliminate individuality so they can function better as a unit.
What I mean by disciplinary system is much more kind of rationality. How can we govern other people, form other people, obtain that?
And that's part of disciplining society. That's part of the panopticon idea of how society works.
The best means, the most economical means, the most efficient means in order to obtain that. And that's the discipline, I think.
Yeah, it's quite ominous, isn't it? All this, like this panopticon business. Like the more we talk about it, the more I'm thinking of various films and books. But it's quite an ominous idea. It like really is like playing upon like just fear, basically, as a control tool. And like, yeah, it's quite a scary concept in a way.
It's the premise of all dystopian novels.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Seeing
sure.
and not being seen. Right. That's the essence upon which, like 1984 and other novels are built. It's the totalitarian society of the invisible power, but the all-present domination, right? Even in the smallest part of your private life, do you always feel like someone is watching you.
Oh, that's creepy when you say it like that.
And here's another quote.
Makes me shudder slightly.
The panoptic mechanism arranges spatial unities that make it possible to see constantly and to recognize immediately. In short, it reverses the principle of the dungeon. Visibility is a trap. Foucault, again, really flamboyant, but it actually makes sense if you think about it.
No, it does. I mean, I don't know whether you want me to talk about this now or whether you'd want to cover like fictional examples later, but it's just really like all of these quotes are making me think so much about Oz, this TV show. I might have mentioned it to you before, but I don't know if many listeners will have seen Oz, but it was something I binge watched it back at university. Basically, it's set in an experimental wing of a prison. It's called Emerald City.
But in M City, the guards are with us 24 hours a day. There's no privacy. Everybody sees what everybody's doing. Eyes are everywhere.
All of the cells that just have this see-through kind of glass or plastic on the front.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's this exactly like the visibility is a trap thing, like the reverse of a dungeon. Like the regular prison is still as normal.
Functioning,
yeah. But there's just this wing, and there's this one particular guy who's driving it in the show, and he thinks it's going to be a really great way to... So he's almost like a Bentham figure, and he thinks that this experimental wing is going to completely change things, reduce violence, all this kind of stuff.
Follow the rules. Learn self-discipline.
The way the prison is set up is definitely a kind of circular. All the cells are see-through, and there's a tower in the center. So it's very, very reminiscent of this. Unfortunately, I mean, in the TV show, like, the people are dying in like every single episode, so it doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, you have to have the drama in a TV show, right?
Yeah, of course. Like, that experimental wing would have been shut down in a heartbeat if it was real life. But it's really interesting. Like, the more of these quotes you're kind of throwing at me, the more I keep thinking of it.
Yeah, no, the centrality of the Watchtower, I mean, it has such a deep, you know, cultural sort of importance. I think that the Latin saying is like, who's watching the watchman? Like, the centrality of the Watchtower as an institution, as a sort of a symbol of power, has always been like really important. And I mean, Lord of the Rings, right? Like, you have the Sauron Tower, obviously.
Yeah.
The all-seeing eye.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's another great one.
Fun fact, do you know which building inspired J.R.R. Tolkien to create the Eye of Sauron?
No.
The clock tower in the University of Birmingham, where I did my bachelor's.
Really?
Yeah, J.R.R. Tolkien apparently saw the watchtower, the clock tower in Birmingham Uni, which is apparently the highest clock tower, I would say, in Europe, maybe in the world.
Oh.
It's like 100 meters tall. And apparently that's what inspired him to create the Tower of Sauron.
Is it foreboding? Like, does it look...
Well, actually, now that I come to think about it, the entire campus is like a circle, and the clock tower is actually in the center.
Oh, maybe they were reading a bit of Bentham back in the day.
Yeah.
They?
This story and this episode that I'm bringing actually has a pretty personal sort of connection to me. First of all, Foucault is kind of like my ultimate hero, and he features really heavily in my PhD.
He's your Stephen, what Stephen King is to me.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's my Stephen. and also, like, I did my PhD at the University College London, where Jeremy Bentham's skeleton is currently, actually. When Jeremy died, I think it was in 1832, he wrote a will that one of his friends sort of dissect his body. And he asked for his skeleton to be preserved, and they sort of made it like a little wax sculpture with his skeleton still inside. So he has like a wax face, and he's still wearing his old clothes.
That's weird.
Yeah, it really, really is. And so Jeremy is preserved in the cabinet in the University College London today, and it's still there, and you can go and check him out.
And he specifically asked that he be sort of on display in public in his will.
Yeah.
Oh, so maybe he was pretty concerned about his legacy then, I guess.
Yeah, well, are you ready to have your mind completely blown?
Oh, go on.
Basically, a couple of years back, in 2016, as students at UCL, we figured out, or we were rather told, that there was actually a hidden camera in the cabinet with Jeremy. And that camera was actually live streaming what Jeremy would be seeing. So it was just basically surveilling all the students that were like coming to check him out. And that was live streamed on YouTube.
Really?
Yeah.
That's weird, isn't it? That's creepy.
Yeah. Guess what it was called?
Some kind of play on Panopticon or something?
Yeah. Panopticam.
Nice. Yeah. So Bentham was kind of literally turned into a Panopticon.
Yeah.
Wow. So this was part of a project, presumably, the university.
One of the departments at the university wanted to basically use it to study pattern recognition algorithms when it came to surveillance. So they were trying to create codes that would quickly recognize different faces in video footage.
Wow.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, I don't think it's live anymore. I think they canned it. So I think it's okay. I think it's just plain old Jeremy now.
I feel like Jeremy, not that I know him at all, but you know, obviously we've been chatting about him for a bit. I feel like based on what he said about displaying himself in public, I feel like he would have approved of that.
Yeah.
Concept. I feel like he'd have liked that.
Yeah, yeah. No, 100%.
Yeah, that's strange though. Okay.
Anyway.
I'm going to go and check it out.
Yeah, you should.
You've piqued my interest.
When we talk about the Panopticon and the idea of the sort of the all-seeing prison, and when you apply it to today's society, the most sort of obvious comparison is the domination of CCTV cameras. Remember when I told you that they couldn't really build a Panopticon until basically now because they just lack the technological advancements to hear and see all the prisoners so that they can keep them under, like, in line? Well, you know, the metaphor of the Panopticon in terms of the CCTV societies is quite obvious. And London is a good example because London is the second most widely watched city in the world after Beijing.
Yeah, I remember reading something about CCTV in the UK is really high, isn't it?
Like crazy. Yeah. And it's part of like a really long-standing government strategy to curb crime and to, you know, increase order, and it's been, you know, it's been the long standing argument that, you know, surveillance actually decreases crime.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's very hard to prove exactly how effective it is, but I imagine for some people it would certainly be a deterrent. But
right, yeah. But I mean, think about it. You know, if you walk into like a shop or something, you know, there's cameras. Like that will be your first deterrent to before you do something, you know, potentially illegal. The sheer presence of cameras everywhere, and your sort of passing or almost subconscious knowledge that you are potentially being watched does affect your behavior. There's no such thing as being invisible in today's world. I think the most convincing way that Jeremy's Panopticon predicted the present is when you look at the internet, particularly the post-Snowden internet, when we figured out millions and millions of people's personal conversation and data and whereabouts were constantly being surveilled and monitored and stuff like that. This episode has obviously been leading up to the fact how the Panopticon predicted sort of the surveillance that we all face on the internet. And as a journalist, but also as an individual who uses social media, I'm constantly aware that anything that I do, whether in private messages or publicly, may find its way back to me. It's becoming a sort of battle between someone's present and offline self versus someone's past and online self. For example, you have cases like Kevin Hart and James Gunn and other celebrities who faced immense criticism for old and, may I say, pretty nasty tweets that were deleted and subsequently resurfaced. Then you have also cases like New York Times' Sarah Jeong, who also faced some backlash for, you know, supposedly racist tweets, which she just said were sort of anti-trolling attempts.
Yeah, and this is really, I guess, it's been kind of an ongoing thing, this theme of people digging up old tweets and using it against people.
Yeah, and it's not just, you know, digging up old tweets, but you know, there's the whole problem with revenge porn, you know, intimate photos that, you know, you share with people that you think are close to you, and you think you're in a safe space, and oftentimes both for men and women, they're used in various ways to cause you harm. And you know, you have the so-called doxing attempts usually linked to far-right trolls, but not exclusively. And you just see this, the internet, which was thought to be this sort of space of freedom and equality, is now basically a giant panopticon where you think that you're on your own and you're not being looked at, but actually, you know, everybody's always watching, always judging, always like on the prowl. You know, whenever something happens on the street, you know, whether it's something as mundane as a protest to something, you know, actually worth seeing, everything is being constantly filmed. We're living in a completely, you know, digitalized, smartified society where everything around us has the capacities, like the hardware, the microphones and the cameras to actually surveil us.
It's like that that classic photo of that came out when it was a photo of Mark Zuckerberg, and you could see his I think computer or laptop or something in it, and he'd the remote webcam on top of his computer, he'd like covered up, or he had a cover on it. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And
classic Mark.
Yeah. It was just this it was this idea that obviously he's concerned about a webcam being on his computer in case it gets hacked and stuff. So, and again, it's like this idea of you never know if you're being watched. So he's just decided to cover that up just in case. And I guess like what you're saying is, probably eventually, or maybe even now, we've got so many devices in our house that could potentially listen to us or have the technological capability to do that, that it's almost like, private spaces really are being almost completely eradicated, to the point where even in your own home you might not.
Yeah, you're seen and heard. But more than that, we are slowly finding out just how unsafe so much of our private data is today. Let's take the latest Facebook scandal, which is really the cherry on top of the cake. In late March, a security researcher broke the news that Facebook had failed to properly protect the passwords of up to 600 million people. Those passwords were stored in plain text, accessible by more than 20,000 Facebook employees.
Yeah, it's scary, isn't it? There's that, like, I think there's that website. Is it Have I Been Pwned? Or
yes.
Is that the one? Yeah, okay. And it basically, you can pop in an email address and it can sort of, it surfaces all the various big kind of data breaches of various social media networks, big companies, you know, like LinkedIn, Yahoo, all these ones that have had these data breaches in the past. And it basically will say whether, you know, your details were involved in one of those breaches. And yeah, it's scary, not just, you know, like even one of them is scary in itself when it's such a ubiquitous platform that everyone uses, but the sheer number, the sheer kind of volume of these that seem to happen fairly regularly is, it's pretty terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, just when I was researching for this for the segment in the episode, I mean, there's just so many breaches that it was almost impossible to follow through them. But if there's one thing that it shows, it's just letting us know, and it allows us to acknowledge the fact that there really is truly nothing that we do online or offline that is off limits.
Yeah, it's a scary thing, and it definitely ties into this idea of this kind of all-seeing eye in a way.
And what's really bizarre, and this will lead me to my final point in a little bit, but what's really bizarre is that a lot of these, specifically with regards to these big tech and surveillance stories, a lot of these stories we only know about because someone blew the whistle. So obviously you have, you know, the really famous story of Snowden blowing the whistle on the NSA spying on millions of people. Then more recently you have the Cambridge Analytica scandal, also revealed through really great reporting and the whistleblower, where you have this small-ish company seemingly, which was actually harvesting the personal data of millions of people using Facebook profiles without these people's consent. And they used it for what later was found out to be political purposes. And we would never have known about these things if, you know, people didn't blow the whistle and did their due diligence with great investigative reporting. Which, Sam, leads me to my final point connecting the Panopticon thread. And it has to do with a slightly worrying question that I don't think anybody really has the answer to. If we know there are those that watch and those that are being watched, is there anyone then tasked with watching the watch people?
How long can we keep this up?
Congress is pushing through some new bill that's going to outlaw masks.
I brought along a clip from a movie.
Oh, go on.
So it's a movie of the graphic novel Watchmen.
Our days are numbered. Until then, it's like you always say, we're society's only protection.
From what?
Are you kidding me? Themselves.
It's a dystopian take on all superheroes. And what you see in the background of this scene is an American flag, and there's a graffiti over it that says, "Who's watching the Watchmen?"
Yeah, "Who's watching the Watchmen?" is a really kind of thought-provoking quote, I suppose, because yeah, it's true. Like, obviously, having a kind of a force for, well, obviously, as in Bentham was hoping, a force for good or a force for kind of efficiency is fine, but like, but then how do you know that that force is, you know, moral in itself, or how do you know that they're doing things for the right reason?
What happened to the American dream? What happened to the American dream? It came true. You're looking at it.
I'm getting closer to the end of this episode, but I just wanted to bring you one last little nugget.
Go on.
So, you know that I'm Bulgarian.
I do.
And the Panopticon plays a pretty big role in my country, as well as other post-socialist societies. So we've been talking about, you know, how it works in the digital sphere, right? How surveillance works through technology, and how the technological revolution was, you know, the final sort of ingredient to the Panopticon sugar, spice and everything nice type thing.
Right.
But in Eastern Europe, with the rise of Stalin, you actually had those watchtowers built in countries across the Eastern Bloc, like Bulgaria and Poland and, you know, Hungary and stuff. You have these large towers. And in Poland, you have the Palace of Culture, which is like this huge, huge building right in the middle of Warsaw, that was built as a gift from the Soviet Union. You have a massive monument in Sofia that celebrates the Red Army's help in defeating the Nazis. You know, you have all these sort of leftover marks that were meant to be the tallest, the most visible, the most dominating piece of a built form in the city. So that even now that the communist regimes have fallen, you know, you have, you know, they still remain the most dominant legacies in terms of architecture.
Yeah, that is really interesting. I guess it's the idea that even if it's not necessarily a watchtower, it's still a kind of reminder of a power kind of structure, isn't it? Like, it's, yeah, like, even if you don't think it's watching you, you're still aware of its presence, and you're aware of what's behind that presence.
Yeah, and it's changing, sort of changing how history is perceived, right? It almost seems like these countries were, you know, the most important part of their history was just, you know, something that lasted 30, 40 years, and yet is the most visible and dominating part of their cityscape. That's all I got for you. It was hopefully not too dense.
No, it was like, I mean, you worried me with the early talk of philosophy, but like, I think it was actually, no, it was not, yeah, it wasn't too dense at all. It was really interesting. It's interesting having like something that I guess I've always been aware of as a kind of trope of fiction, like this idea of a kind of tower or a kind of all-seeing eye. Like, it's interesting kind of tracking that back to its roots. So like I'd never heard the phrase panopticon before, and it's interesting seeing all of these examples in real life and in fiction that have kind of come throughout the years. And yeah,
lay me your Stephen King.
How did you know I was going in that direction? You could see the glint in my eye, couldn't you? No, I was going
to
say.
Give it to me.
No, yeah, I mean, obviously, like, yeah, Stephen King has kind of done some dystopian stuff, but also his central kind of series of novels, The Dark Tower, like, it's that, it immediately made me think of those, like this idea of it's not a tower that's necessarily constantly visible, but it's something that's constantly present and the characters in the series are always aware of, and it's kind of their central goal. And basically the tower in the Dark Tower series is like the nexus of time and space. So it's literally an object holding all time and space together, and it's the center of the main group of characters' quest. Like, it's their ultimate goal to get there. But there's also forces that are kind of associated with the tower that keep cropping up and kind of interfering with them. So yeah, it kind of reminded me of that series of novels, which again, definitely worth a read.
I wonder how many of these people, from the sci-fi stories that we're bringing up, I wonder how many of them actually know of Jeremy Bentham and of the Panopticon, or whether it's something that they just, you know, they just have had their pulse on society like so well that they just sort of sensed it.
Yeah, well, I think it's an interesting question. I think it's so woven into, as you were saying, society now, this idea of being watched, that I guess maybe some people have kind of picked it up through that, but perhaps, I mean, certainly I'd never heard of him before that you told me about him. So
you're going to see him in UCL?
I'm going to go see him in UCL. I think I am. Yeah, I'm interested now. Yeah.
All right.
You know, if I was to assess how good a fiction prediction this is, I'd say it's pretty impressive and kind of all kind of encompassing, because you found something that is like, yeah, it appears so much in society and so much in fiction that there's like just loads and loads of examples rather than just one.
Hmm.
I guess the only thing is, does it qualify as fiction, do you think?
Ah.
That's the question, isn't it? I guess in some ways, I was thinking about this quite a lot, and I guess it's, he meant it as a non-fiction concept, but it was never really realized in his time, so it was kind of just an idea almost. So I feel like you can almost get away with it.
I think I see where you're coming from. I think it's not as clear-cut as, you know, the first episode that we did about Stephen King and Donald Trump. But
great episode.
I think, sure, yeah. of course, it's our debut episode. But do you know what? I think the importance is not necessarily the physicality of Bentham's panopticon itself. I think it's each iteration that it has in every dystopian novel or film or, you know, philosophical interpretation just adds another layer of fiction to it.
I guess I know it's like good when it immediately makes me think of loads of examples that I hadn't really kind of grouped together consciously before, or like a potential source for loads of different things I've seen throughout fiction. So no, it's I think it's really good.
The perfect fiction prediction. Sorry, Stephen King.
Ooh, the perfect fiction prediction. We're only on episode two.
I mean, I don't even know.
Have you busted out your biggest guns too early? Like, is this the?
Yeah, I'm gonna go out on a limb and say that the Panopticon is gonna be my greatest contribution. So that's the end of this episode, guys. Thanks for tuning in. We've got a very special guest for our next one. It's Stephen Merchant. Stephen is the co-creator of the era-defining sitcom The Office, and he recently wrote and directed the film Fighting With My Family. We had Stephen come on the pod to talk about what it's like to create things that end up having such a transformative impact on the contemporary culture, and also to see if he had any fiction predictions up his long sleeves.
I'm going to do a massive name drop right now. I don't know, maybe you want to throw in some kind of jingle?
Name drop.
Because this is pretty heavy-handed name drop, but I was talking to Tom Cruise once.
And if you don't mind, guys, give us a comment or a rating on Apple Podcasts or whichever streaming platform you're using to listen to us.
Yes, and also really importantly, we want to make Fiction Predictions a collaborative effort. So we're relying on you guys to guide us towards pieces of fiction that you think deserve to be on this podcast. So please send us your suggestions.
Yeah, that's right. You can tweet your fiction predictions directly at us. It's Sam Hasem and Nikolai_Nikolov.
We look forward to hearing from you.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Fiction Predictions.
Fiction Predictions is a Mashable podcast created by Nikolai Nikolov and Sam Hasem. The theme song was composed by Kasberg. The artwork was designed by Bob Algarin. And this episode was edited by me.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.